Good morning. I'm opening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue Thursday, May 30th. A number of bills are on our agenda for a work session. We will start at the top of the agenda, and then things will change a little bit. For any of you here who are interested in House Bill 2053A, we will not be having a full work session and taking action on that bill this morning. We may have time to for the committee to hear a little bit more about it and discuss it later in the agenda, but we will not be taking action today on 2053A. And Senate Bill 769 will not be ready to move today. There are some amendments, and if there's time, we'll hear about what the amendments do, but we will not be taking action on that one today either. Starting at the top, I'm opening a work session on Senate Bill 459A.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 459A, just as a reminder, this is a bill relating to two auction tax credits, the film and video and the opportunity grant auction tax credits. And the changes, again, were just decreasing the reserve price from 95%. So this is an auction tax credit. Again, the face value of the reserve price from 95% to 90%, and then also adjusting the time at which these auctions could occur. And this is in an effort to increase the likelihood that these auctions will be successful in selling out the full allotment of credits. We do have the paperwork on this. The fiscal is minimal, and the revenue impact statement at this time is indeterminate because, again, there are some unknowns a bit going forward with how these auction credits will interact with some of the clarification language that came out at the federal level related to states and auction tax credits. So we'll be curious to see how these auctions play out with these changes.
Good. Thank you. Is there a motion?
Chair Nathanson, I move SB 459A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Marsh moves Senate Bill 459A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Objections? Oh, Representative Smith Warner.
Discussion. Thank you, Madam Chair. I am happy to support this. You know, it's challenging. We always want our tax credits to be used for. They are some policy tools, and I do feel as though the Film Production Development Credit is one of the clearly most useful one. You can draw such a straight line between that tax credit and job creation in that state that fully meets the but for these would not happen. And as Kyle mentioned, the interplay with the changes in the federal tax rates really is impacting our ability to do these policy things at the state level. So I am... while I share some concern that we've heard about lowering the reserve amounts, because they can still go for higher amounts, I think this is a kind of a reasoned, careful next step to take about how we can continue to promote these things that we know are supporting our policy goals, and hoping to maximize their ability to succeed. So I will be a yes on this.
Thank you for your comments. Any other discussion? Objections? Motion passes. We need a carrier.
Thank you, Representative. I just talked myself into that.
Just did.
I'm closing the work session on Senate Bill 459A. I'm opening a work session on Senate Bill 193A.
Good morning, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. Senate Bill 193A deals with the apportionment method for interstate broadcasters. This bill temporarily extends the commercial domicile factor method of apportionment for tax year 2019, and it requires LRO in consultation with the Department of Revenue to study this apportionment method and the related findings from legal cases and submit a report with these results by the end of, or by December 15th, 2019. There is an indeterminate revenue impact statement due to the ongoing litigation. It's difficult to estimate the revenue effects of continuing with this method of apportionment, and there is a minimal fiscal impact.
Thank you. We ready for a motion?
Vice Chair Nathanson, I move Senate Bill 193A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Marsh moves Senate Bill 193A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Objections? Motion passes.
Carrier.
Representative Smith, will you take a turn? Thank you. Closing the work session on Senate Bill 193A. Opening a work session on Senate Bill 718.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 718 just deals with some filing requirements with the Oregon Tax Court. It basically expands the ability to include mailing methods beyond the U.S. Postal Service. There is no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Chair Nathanson, I move Senate Bill 718 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Marsh moves Senate Bill 718 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Objections? Motion passes. Representative Reschke, thank you.
And when you present this in the House, you're going to talk about there's something other than Pony Express and
USPS. You never know.
Carrier pigeon.
Something like that. Closing the work session on Senate Bill 718. You ready?
I'm ready.
Opening a work session on House Bill 2449A.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2449A deals with the tax for emergency communication currently placed on communications providers at 75 cents per month or per transaction. This phases that in over 2 years to $1.25 and also phases the percentage in for administrative fees to be net revenue neutral. And so this generates in the first biennium because it's just effective for 1 year and at the lower rate of $1, $14.6 million additional dollars, and in the next two biennium that increases to a little over $60 million.
Thank you.
You ready?
Would someone like to make a motion?
Chair Nathanson, I move that the dash A13 amendment be adopted in House Bill 2449A.
Representative Finley moves the dash A13 amendment adopted into House Bill 2449A. Discussion. This motion is about the amendment. Yes, Representative Smith.
Oh, I'll hold tight on the amendment. I'll hold tight.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
Any objections? Yes.
I would visit a little bit of discussion.
Good.
The A13 is indicative of this has been a work in progress for a long time. There's been a lot of collaboration. There's been a lot of great folks stepped up and helped work on this from industry to state to the Office of Emergency Management to Department of Revenue to a lot of folks. It's been a lot of great hard work, and I'm very happy to say that this looks like it's coming together. So, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Good. Any other discussion on this motion? Any objections? Motion passes.
Chair Nathanson, I move that House Bill 2449A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Finley moves House Bill 2449A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I look at the staff measure summary, it reminds us that the current fee has not been updated since 1991. And I remember back in 2001 and 2003, very, very intense conversations on raising the 911 fee. As a matter of fact, I remember sitting at the dais with Representative Patridge, who I believe was out of Medford, and myself. He was on one side of the issue, I was on the other. And at the time, my boys had just been through a very, very serious auto accident in Wheeler County in what are commonly known as the S-curves. And but for the fact that our 911 folks understood where the S-curves are in Wheeler County, more serious repercussions could have occurred. And so I'm really pleased to see that Representative Finley and you, Madam Chair, have stepped up to work through this issue. And so I'm pleased to be a yes vote on this.
Thank you. Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair. I'm supportive of the bill, and I wanted to call out the need, though, to be clear that this is not the end of the conversation. I think Rep. Finley and Chair Nathanson may speak to this here in a moment. He's made a commitment to a work group process that will occur in the interim. I think there are certainly questions about efficiencies within the 911 system and the multiple entities that we have that are serving as PSAPs. Not to say that they're not doing a fine job, but we really need to look at how to fund the system and how to run it efficiently. And we also need to look at how to transition to next generation technology, how to bring in some federal funds that will enable us to do that. So I look forward to the process of a deep conversation.
Good. Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would have preferred we sought after the efficiency first before taxing further, but I'll be a no, but not a loud no, because my district will obviously benefit from this increase, and yeah.
Thank you. I am very pleased to support this bill today to provide additional revenue to help dealing with the increase in call volume, costs, and upgrades for 911 call centers. The centers called PSAPs. They play an obvious and key role in public safety throughout the state. And you will notice that I'm going to read some remarks because I thought very carefully about what I wanted to say today. I believe the need for this is there. I appreciate Representative Finley's work to get us here and bringing this to us. Over time, the total number of PSAPs in Oregon has steadily declined until about 10 years ago. This perhaps is speaking to something that Representative Reschke was thinking about. In 1981, there were over 280 PSAPs. By 1991, there were 64. And by 2010, there were 49 primary PSAPs. And since then, there has been little change in the number of primary PSAPs, and there are also 14 secondary PSAPs. Since 1995, the Office of Emergency Management and the Oregon Military Department have convened work groups and hired consultants. We've received reports, and many of us have read those reports over the last decade. The Kimball Report was published in 2012, and it tells us, quote, "For the state of Oregon, improving service levels is the single most important reason to consider consolidation." I'm going to repeat that. Improving service levels is the single most important reason to consider consolidation. Transfer of 911 calls between PSAPs can be reduced or eliminated, often improving response times and lowering the potential for human or technology errors. The dramatic changes in the telecommunications industry over the past 15 years, remember this was written in 2012, and speaking to Representative Marsh's point also, over the past 15 years has made it difficult for public safety and emergency communication systems to keep pace. While the consolidation process is complex and difficult, if implemented correctly, it can yield substantial improvements in service levels, regional interoperability, responder safety, employee retention, and potential cost savings. From a state perspective, consolidation encourages interagency cooperation, more effective use of resources, and large-scale incident management. It could also mean more efficient, streamlined, and cost-effective technology, end quote. And that's one of the keys that I'm particularly interested in, where we need to replace and upgrade systems. What is the very best way for us to spend these limited dollars to make sure that we have the very best technology and the very best equipment available to help our first responders, to help our dispatchers and call takers, and ultimately, this is to serve the citizens of Oregon. Interestingly, that report from 2012 also said, the recommended number of PSAPs to handle the call volume in Oregon is 9 PSAPs with a total of 70 workstations. That was 9 and 70. We have, at the time these notes were written, we have 49 call centers, as opposed to 9 recommended, and 279 workstations. I want to be sure that every dollar we spend is spent in the best way possible. It is time to roll up our sleeves and tackle this. It's important to ensure the best possible service and a modern and right-sized system. I would like LPRO, and by the way, I want to really thank the staff of LPRO for helping me dig up some old materials and review them again before today's meeting. I would really like LPRO to convene a work group during the interim. And I know there are at least a couple of people in this room who would like to participate in that conversation. The discussion should include meeting public safety needs, utilizing the most appropriate technology in a fast-changing environment, and the feasibility of using financial mechanisms to encourage best practices and right sizing of the system of PSAPs for emergency call taking. So, more to work on, but we certainly need the additional revenue to get started in upgrading the systems that we do have. Are there any other comments about this main motion? Any objections to the motion? Yes, Representative Reschke, but it was a quiet one, as you pointed out.
It was a quiet. I just put my hand out, and then
courtesy bill.
Motion passes. Thank you. Representative Finley will be the carrier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd just like to thank you for your help, and this has been a bigger lift than I ever thought it would be, and I appreciate your help.
Closing the work session on House Bill 2449A. Have some time available. We'll stand at ease just for about 60 seconds while we determine what's ready and what we're going to move to next. Bill 769. I do not anticipate resolving or completing this, but I'm opening the work session so that we can hear about two amendments that have been prepared.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 769 deals with the payment in lieu of taxes for solar property owners. And the original bill would streamline the process of payments and also allocation of those fees back to the local governments to put them in line with standard property taxes. So there's two amendments, one regarding the clawback that is in the bill. So if a solar property owner defaults or exits the payment in lieu of taxes program, there is currently a clawback, I believe, for 1 year of the property taxes, the difference in the property taxes that were owed between that and the payment in lieu of taxes. This dash two would essentially take that. I think we have a graph that Austin might be able to pull up. There is
no.
So the way the payment in lieu of tax is structured is that if you have property and it is depreciating, then you can imagine over the period of time that you own that property, the property taxes that you would owe would also be decreasing. And so that's kind of that curved line in this graph here and it is handwritten. So those would be the taxes that you would be paying on depreciated property over time. The way the payment in lieu of taxes is structured is that you pay a flat rate per capacity of your system along the entire period of time that you're in this payment in lieu of taxes program. If you were in the program, and I've designated this, say, at 6 years, and you decided to back out of the program, at that point, you would revert to the sort of brown line or the lower line in paying taxes. So you'd first be paying along the green line, which is lower than standard property taxes. And then if you were to default, you would start paying along the lower line. And so the way that the property tax or the payment in lieu of property tax was structured was this idea that you would pay less in the beginning and a little bit more later so that the payment would be consistent for those property owners to give them a predictable payment stream. But if they're able to back out, then the total amount of property taxes collected over the period of that payment in lieu of taxes would not be the same as what you would collect under standard property taxes. This clawback, or the dash two, which adjusts the clawback to recoup the difference or the gap in those two graphs in the period prior to default, would reconcile that issue.
Thank you. Any questions about this one? Representative Reschke.
Who's the artist?
Madam Chair, I would share with you that was an excellent explanation. The primary reason businesses use the payment in lieu of taxes is, as was mentioned, they want predictability in their payment schedule. What's happening is with these solar projects, they go out and they negotiate contracts for the sale of the power, and the projects are all predicated on predictability. And so payment in lieu allows for that. They've been a great tool in Representative Finley's district and in my district to assist in that form of power generation. So strongly support this.
Thank you. Representative Finley.
So you have a question, and I think I've read this, is that this does not allow, if you sign on to the payment in lieu of taxes program, it does not allow stacking of other property tax incentives, such as enterprise zones or anything else. I mean, they can't stack all these on top of it. If you do the payment in lieu of taxes option, you are no longer eligible for any other property tax relief. So this is... So it establishes a steady, fixed number for the fixed term, and there's no other variables to that. So.
Yes, that's exactly right, Representative. And then in addition to that, your local government's able to negotiate what those agreements look like.
Yep, absolutely.
Are we ready to move to the next amendment?
Thank you, Chair. And okay, so we have also another amendment. And so this this amendment would deal with this would deal with the issue the way that the payment in lieu of taxes is structured, as you just saw, is dependent on the capacity of the project. So if the project were damaged, then the capacity would decrease. And if the project were to add on some solar panels, then the capacity of the project would increase. And so this amendment would require recertification of the capacity on an annual basis. This is my understanding. We just got it this morning, and there are some people here that are able to talk a little more in depth if that's required.
We have a few minutes left. Yes, if there's someone here who would like to spend maybe just 2 minutes explaining this, I'd appreciate it.
Chair Nathanson and members of the committee, for the record, Eric Kanzler representing the Oregon State Association of County Assessors. This bill was first requested by us, and the amendment was requested by us. Really, what we are talking about here for the payment in lieu of program is the procedure by which the solar project owner relays the necessary information first to the Department of Revenue and then back to the County Assessors to assure that we know the nameplate capacity every year. And we multiply that by 7,000, which is the term in statute for computing the ultimate payment amount. And then we can very cleanly, through the property tax system, send out the bill, get the payment, distribute the revenue. So it's a technical fix to a bill that we see as a technical fix to begin with. A discussion draft was circulated amongst representatives from the solar industry as well. The final details in the dash three are a little bit different than the discussion draft of the dash one. The dash three was issued late yesterday. I don't have feedback yet from the solar industry. I would expect they would be okay with this, but I'd like to hear from them, since what we're looking for is an administrative fix that works for them as well.
Thank you. Any questions? Yes, Representative Rushkey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So does the solar company need to recertify every year, or if it's just if the capacity changes one way or another?
Madam Chair, Representative Reske, just as a matter of diligence, and every year they're going to be filing an annual report with the Department of Revenue. So what this would basically add to that is just include the megawatts in that report. Okay. And literally nothing more, and then the process would otherwise be the same.
Thank you.
Yes.
Yes. Thank you. I apologize. I didn't cue in on something until right now. What do we benefit? How do we benefit by knowing the megawatts?
I'm sorry. Could you restate that?
How do we benefit by requiring the companies to tell us what the megawatts are? How do we benefit from that as a state?
Chair Nathanson, Representative Smith. The need for the reporting of the megawatts is simply to calculate the pilot amount by multiplying that by 7,000. Yeah.
Thank you. Okay.
Good. Thank you for joining us for the explanation. We will reschedule this bill for another day. We'll wait to hear from Mr. Kanzler and from LRO. I'm closing the work session on Senate Bill 769. I would like to have maybe a 3-minute update from Legislative Revenue Office on House Bill 2053A. I'm opening a work session for the purpose of hearing an update, House Bill 2053A.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. So House Bill 2053A, as a reminder, this deals with four programs that Business Oregon offers or administers. And the measure adds to statute or clarifies definitions in statute related to things that these programs use, like average wage, compensation, community, local government, et cetera. It also changes statute related to one of the programs to count rural employees twice. And it, the four programs it deals with are the Business Retention and Expansion Program, or BEP, Enterprise Zones, Long-Term Rural Enterprise Zones, and Business Development Income Tax Exemption, which you've probably heard referred to as Oregon Investment Advantage, and then also the RISIS program, the Oregon Industrial Site Readiness. Currently, there is a fiscal in, and it is no fiscal impact, and as an office, we're still working on the revenue impact, given that there are so many programs, and they affect different areas of tax policy. It's just taking us some more time. So that's where things are right now.
Good, thank you. So when we have a revenue impact statement available, then we will take this up again. Thank you. I'm closing the work session on House Bill 2053A. And I'm going to open these simultaneously. Okay. I'm opening a work session on House Bill 2164 and also on House Bill 2126, and I would like Mr. Alanak to explain what these bills are about.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, these both of these vehicles have certain relating to clauses that will help the JTAX, Joint Committee on Tax Expenditures, finish its work. The reason there are two vehicles is one is relating to taxation, the other is relating to state finance, and I'm having conversations with Ledge Council, and the exact amendments that the work that JTAX will be doing is still a little bit up in the air, so we're not sure which relating to clause will work. So the intent here is just to move them down to the Joint Committee on Tax Expenditures, so that committee, which you are largely part of it, can do its work.
Good, thank you. So this is just a sort of a routine how to keep the trains moving, so to speak. We're just moving a bill from our committee to another committee. And do we have a fiscal light yet?
Each of the bills has a revenue light statement and a fiscal light statement.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Alanak or any discussion?
I look forward to seeing what they look like when they get there.
And what we do to them after they get there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Any other comments? Okay, so we need, we probably need a motion.
Yes.
To, here we are. Who would like to make the motions?
Madam Chair, I move the House Bill 2126 to the floor with a due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Tax Expenditures.
Thank you. Vice Chair Finley moves House Bill 2126 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Tax Expenditures. Any other discussion? Objections? Thank you. Motion passes.
Madam Chair, I move that House Bill 2164 to the floor with a due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Tax Expenditures.
Thank you. Vice Chair Finley moves House Bill 2164 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Tax Expenditures. Discussion? Objections? Motion passes. There's another business on these bills, so I am now closing the work session on House Bills 2164 and 2126. We completed our agenda today. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good job.